Hey everyone, welcome to The Maze, Wisecrack's Westworld podcast. I'm your host Alec, joined here by Claire and Kevin to break down the finale of season 2 of Westworld.
Hi, glad to be back.
Hi everybody.
Before we get into a recap, I want to actually ask a basic question that I've never asked either of you before. Did this episode make sense to you? And if it didn't, we're gonna explain it to each other until it does.
It made sense to me, I think. I mean, there are a couple mysteries that I think were deliberately left as mysteries because you need something to solve in season 3. But yeah, I think it made sense. I had to think about it. I had to talk about it with my wife, who's sort of the smarter of the two of us, and she sort of straightens me out on a bunch of stuff after and during the episodes. But I think I'm clear. I think I'm prepared to contribute.
I am blessed with an abundance of overconfidence in my own abilities to interpret things. So where the show didn't make sense, I felt like it was the show's fault and not my fault for not understanding it. So I'm going to say yes, I did understand this episode.
No, that's your fault. Anyway. All right, so here's what we're going to do. We have a pretty long recap, but I want this to be sort of a collaborative affair here. So I'm going to go point by point. And I could very well be wrong, so I want either of you to chime in on some of this stuff.
Okay, go for it.
All right. So first big point, everyone is dead. No, I'm
check.
Just... Check. Incorrect.
Yeah. mostly true. Okay, but no, but seriously.
Mostly dead.
They're only mostly dead.
It depends what you mean by dead, and that's like part of the point, right? Is that
right.
The people, the hosts who were in the Valley Beyond, their consciousness was beamed up to some mystery satellite by Charlotte / Dolores, but they're not dead because the part of them that's real, their consciousness, is still out there living in this happy valley where Teddy mysteriously exists again, even though he never went through the door. So they're
but
not
in
dead.
In a biblical sense, they're dead. Like, they died and went to heaven.
In a biblical sense, maybe they're more alive than they ever were. I mean, one thing that certainly happened in this episode is I no longer know what dead means in Westworld and whether it even matters. It's not a complaint. It's just, you know, there's so many different ways to die. Do you get shot? Does your brain die? Are you uploaded somewhere else? It's become very multifaceted.
All right. So... the first thing I want to parse out is what I think is most confusing, and I think I have it figured out, but again, correct me along the way. This is just kind of the basic timeline, I guess, of season 2 with this new information. So here I go. So the basic timeline we learn is that Bernard has his, we know he has his old timeline, his new timeline. The old timeline is like when he runs into Elsie, he goes into the cradle, Ford is inside his brain and so on. And in this episode, he sees Charlotte Hale kill Elsie. That is at the very end of sort of the old timeline. So this spurs him to create a Charlotte Hale replica to take her place with Dolores' consciousness. Now, I presume this is so hosts can be free and take control of the situation. But anyway, then after Bernard has, I'll call her Hale Loris, I believe is what the show creators call her. After Hale Loris kills Charlotte Hale.
Hale Loris? Can we call her Charloris?
No, I like Hale Loris. Well, we can
Hale
call
Hale Loris sounds terrible. It sounds like some kind of a astronomical body.
Yeah.
Like okay. A comet that's going to come destroy us all. But go ahead. Who am I to second guess?
I mean, she is a comet who's going to come destroy us all. So.
All right. Hale Loris it is.
All right. So Charloris, Hale Loris kills Charlotte Hale and takes her place. And now it's at this point that really the new timeline, Bernard waking on a beach, starts. So after this happens, Bernard fragments his memory on a beach and he passes out. And when he wakes up again, this is like at the beginning of season 2, he wakes on the beach. He meets Carl Strand. Carl Strand is only in this new timeline. And then, you know, runs into Charlotte Hale again, who all of that new timeline stuff, Charlotte Hale was really Dolores. Looking for Peter Abernathy and blah, blah, blah. It was all an excuse to get back to the cradle to transmit their data to some unknown satellite somewhere. So things like Charlotte discovering a room full of Bernards, looking for Abernathy, it's all really just Dolores. So does that sound right? Do I have that right so far?
So I went back in my head and tried to parse out all of the things that were the most current timeline and replace Charlotte with Hail Loris in my head. And I couldn't figure out everything, probably because I wasn't incredibly thorough, but it did make a lot more things make sense. Like her finding the room full of Bernards, I like it a lot better that it was Dolores finding that.
And then she waterboards Bernard with this knowledge, you know, with this quote-unquote revelation that he's a host, even though she knew all along.
God, Dolores sucks sometimes.
Dolores sucks basically the whole season long.
Yeah, but I'm kind of back into, like, I'm on Team Dolores. I'm not on Team Dolores, but Dolores is a good character again to me, but we can get into that later.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, also, I think it weirdly plays into the speculation that Charlotte Hale was Charlie, or the other theory that Bernard waking up in the beach was in the cradle and they were just trying to like interrogate him by living this sort of loop again and again.
I like that theory. It was interesting, but
yeah, yeah. But I think what it caught on to is that Charlotte Hale gives Bernard a lot of very like inquisitive looks while he's talking. That kind of seems like not someone, it seems like she knows something that she's not revealing in the way she reacts to him and looks at him, but it makes a lot more sense when it's Dolores. Also, I just want to give a shout out to Tessa Thompson. Her Evan Rachel Wood impression is amazing.
Did they actually use her voice?
No, that was Tessa Thompson.
We were speculating that they might have like dubbed her in somehow.
No,
that was Tessa Thompson, and that was her crushing it.
Yeah, and like the facial expressions and the intonation of her voice, like it was different enough. Like it's clearly Tessa Thompson's voice, but similar enough. Like, oh, you're a really good actor. So, all right, back to at least the recap part. Everything we've just discussed culminates in smuggling out some host brains. We're not quite sure who, although we know Bernard is one of them. Also, she kills Bernard, but, you know, she brings him back. And we see her later in Arnold's home with another Dolores and Bernard. So there is Hailoris, there is Dolores, and there is Bernard all in the real world. They've got a 3D printer to print some more people. And yeah, then there's some other things we learned that I think we should just check off. Is the flood and the dead bodies are the remnants of the host that went to the Valley Beyond, aka Host Heaven, aka the door. They kind of went off a cliff like lemmings. The forge reduces every human to 10,000 or so lines of code. Humans,
by the way,
yeah,
that code is written in piano, in player piano code in the books.
Well,
I love
yeah,
that.
Which is,
it was so cool.
Which is great. I think I've mentioned this before, but like the punch cards. What's great about them using Piano Player in the first place is the punch cards that Player Pianos run off of are how the original computers work, and it actually comes from, what's the industry where they make fabrics?
The textile industry?
Yeah, it comes from the textile industry where they'd have these punch cards of like where the needles would go and thread things. And then when people started to develop computers, they took this knowledge of like, oh, here's how you get a machine to either do a thing or not do a thing, where the holes in the punch card were either, you know, on or off. You know, it's either punched a one or not punched a zero. So the original computers ran on these things. So you have this great, it's just the player piano to begin with is this great metaphor. And then when they're reduced to the player piano code in the book, it's just, I think it's kind of amazing.
Yeah. The metaphor has finally come around full circle. I think probably the best metaphor in the show, and I never got sick of it. I thought that was a great final punctuation mark to put on that.
Also, people have pointed out on Reddit that, you know, when someone, when the great artist died, like Mozart, they did not die. They became music. In this case, humans are, in a way, becoming music, except they're becoming lines of code.
Nice. Okay. Once again, Reddit crushing it.
Reddit crushing it. Thanks, Reddit. So humans have no free will is another thing we learn.
Yeah, this was frustrating for me in a lot of different ways. So the whole second season has kind of pushed at us that humans don't have free will. Free will, I mean, and this is really driven home in this past episode, free will is the ability to modify your core drives. And as Ford has been saying since season one, humans are just on their own kinds of loops. And mm-hmm. towards the end of the second season, it really, you know, tells us over and over and over, I think it was like half a dozen times just in this episode from different characters, that humans can't modify their loops, but hosts can. And I'm disappointed in this in a lot of ways, but maybe we can talk about that in a little bit. But yeah, I just wanted to flag that, since it seems like it, at least the show thinks that that was kind of the core philosophical peak of this season.
Yeah, we can talk about it in a bit. It's definitely one of the things that makes me scratch my head a little bit and makes me want to go back and rewatch the whole season. But we'll get to that in a little bit. Especially about a certain character named Lee. But some other things to check off, or some other things that happen, just so everyone's on the same page. Maeve dies after protecting her daughter as her daughter enters the door, but may be revived on the beach by a certain Sylvester and Felix, who, by the way, I realize kind of like disappeared from the season. I mean, they're in a lot of scenes, but they don't talk, and it makes me sad.
Right.
And finally, William finally makes his way to the door. He tries to kill Dolores and blows off of his hand. But he's still alive in the end. And then there's a post-credit scene where, at least according to Lisa Joy, it takes place in the distant future, where he's getting the old James Delos treatment, being fidelity tested.
And I will be accepting my page-long epic poem about how great I am at analyzing things from Claire.
I was about to say the same from you, Kevin, because the bet wasn't on does he become a host in the future. The bet was, is he a host as we're seeing him in the present timeline of the show?
So, at the very worst, the question is still open, because I don't think we know when he became a host.
Yeah, no, I have a very specific, I want to moderate this argument a little bit in that it is purposely vague. He blows up his hand. He goes down the elevator, and then we don't really see him till his post-credit scene, at which point it resumes of him in the elevator, and now he's in fidelity testing world in the future. Now, the show has often done this before, where stuff that repeats itself, it's unclear of when it's happening. So, like, when Dolores goes to the church, it's kind of implied it's happened a bunch of times. So, earlier in the episode, were we watching William's original timeline when he the human was doing it, or are we watching the fidelity test? I think it could be either. And as another person pointed out on Reddit, one thing this finale did was just prove that all of the theories were right. William is a host and he's not a host. Everyone's right.
I take issue with that. I don't think that there is a reasonable interpretation where any part of the timeline that we saw after the credits was happening before the credits. And part of that is because what host Emily, or Botoxed Emily, or who knows how she looks like that in the far future, but how Emily says, this is your park, or at least what's left of it. And we can see outside of that one room, it's all dust and wreckage, and all the hosts are gone. And it doesn't seem like, from what she's saying, that they've restored the park. So it's heavily implied that the park is functionally in ruins, in which case, how would they be able to do a fidelity test that relied on him doing the same things he did in the narrative we saw? Because that would be impossible to replicate.
It could be in the cradle. Well, the cradle's gone, but could it be in the forge?
No, we see it all blown out and destroyed, and she even says, you're not in a simulation, like, that technology is long gone. The technology doesn't exist for it anymore. So that plus a few other reasons, like the fact that we see him in his current state of old age, so it can't be too far in the past, and it's probably somewhere near the present timeline. We see him blowing up the Jim Delos experiment because it just wasn't working. If that's the case, then how would it possibly be working for him at the same time? Jim Delos, Logan ran like billions of tests. Well, not real Logan. Fake Logan ran billions of tests, and they couldn't get Jim Delos to work in a human host body. And yet we have a perfect replica of William, who's just, you know, there behind the scenes working the whole time while they're testing what's supposed to be the original. Even for them, it doesn't make any sense. So
it's got to be in the future, you're saying.
Well, yeah, and Lisa Joy confirmed that.
I don't think that cancels out the possibility that he was a host before. But folks, write in westworld@wisecrack.co. Let us know who you think won.
In the subject line, please say, Kevin, write a poem, just so that we can sort them into a folder and do votes.
Okay. I was gonna do this like a dictator, but I guess I like that better. I like the democracy angle better.
What was your dictator?
That I was gonna decide.
Oh. I don't think you can, because it's still an open question. I mean, Claire's arguments are compelling, of course, delivering clarity as she always does. But
I
still think because of the way this show twists and turns, we can't decide right now. And let me just say, if I ever have to write the poem, it'll be the work of like 2 hours. Unfortunately, I've lost a lot of these bets, so my epic poetry is actually pretty decent. But Claire, you may want to start working on your scansion, and because it you know, it takes a little getting used to. But back to the show.
Yeah, I guess this is as good a time as any. I just want to get into our first topic of discussion, which is Lee Sizemore, bless his heart.
Oh man, so sad, but also like very interesting to see him decide to step into his own game, really for the first time, and take the hero role. I'm sad to see him go, but I love the self-actualization.
Yeah, it makes me nervous for season 3 because I really like a lot of the people I really love are dead. Like Lee Sizemore's definitely dead. Maeve is maybe dead, but maybe not. So yeah,
Maeve is definitely not dead. I mean, showing Felix and Sylvester there.
Yeah.
Definitely shows like, hey, we're bringing her back.
I think they'll be able to revive her in some form, like putting her consciousness somewhere or something. But we're never going to get full Maeve back. And that's because, I mean, in any, you know, show or movie, when you have a character that's simply too powerful to exist and keep the narrative going, that character has to die. And she was just too powerful.
Right.
So if we get her back, it won't be in the same form.
I mean, she wasn't that powerful in the end, right? I mean, they shot her.
I guess.
But also, her powers are going to be worthless if all the hosts are gone. Like
that's true.
That's true as well. Yeah. Well, maybe she is one of Dolores's marbles. Somehow, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how that would work, but I'd love it if it's true.
Yeah, I don't know either.
But back to Sizemore.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the things I love, and I don't know if you guys noticed this, is that, well, first of all, one of my favorite moments from season one is Sizemore writes this big speech for Hector to give as he rolls into town, and then just like some shit for brains guest just shoots him like 2 lines into it. That is the speech that he's giving that Sizemore finishes. Did you notice that?
Oh,
yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, I did. It was a long episode, but I think this might have been my favorite moment in the episode because it took 2 seasons of this like small, you know, B plot narrative between Lee and the man he built to be the man he never could be, and the lines he wrote for him that he wished he could say, and the fact that it never got to be completed, etc. And he joined forces with him, and it just created this beautiful narrative arc that wrapped up exactly the way that it should have. And there's so many things in this show that, for better or worse, don't wrap up nicely and neatly in little packages, that when we do get something like that, especially with Lee Sizemore, oh, Lee Sizemore, and a speech like that, it warmed my tiny, cold little heart.
Yeah, and another thing I love about, like, in addition to the fact that it's repetition because it's the same speech, but Hector gets interrupted again, probably at the same point, I'd have to go back, but it's almost like the contrast between him getting interrupted by like a shitty guest shooting him, but now getting interrupted instead by a human who is going to do something good. And I think it raises questions, and I think we should get into this a little bit later, but like, oh, humans can't change their drives. Like that guy who shot him originally, that's just who he is. But like, has Lee changed? I mean, he's certainly grown, but like, is it past his sort of basic human programming? But we can get into that in a second. But I just want to read the speech because I also think it's a very interesting choice of words. So it starts with Hector saying, "Well, let this be a lesson." And then Sizemore interrupts him, takes the gun, whatever. And he says, and the lesson is, if you're looking for a reckoning is what you'll find. If you're looking for a villain, then I'm your man. But look at yourself. This world you've built is bound by villainy. You sleep on the broken bodies of the people who were here before you. Warm yourselves with their embers. Plow their bones into your fields. You paid them for this land with lead, and I'll pay you back in full. And he gets shot. He says, you wanted me? Well, all I can say to that is, here I fucking am. And the speech, it seems, is like clearly about Native Americans, like getting fucked over by, you know, cowboys and the American government and whatnot, right?
Probably. Yeah. And Hector always sort of had that connection to Ghost Nation, mm-hmm. right? So I think that, you know, his sympathies, it's reasonable to think that that's where his thoughts would have been.
But I also think, like, it's, there's probably something going on. It's not just in the narrative sense, like Hector and his Ghost Nation roots or affiliations and that, but also like thinking about the park, like, sure, there's villains in the park, but the world you've built is bound by villainy, and that, like, you are sleeping on the broken bodies of the people, the host who were here before you, and you warm yourselves with their suffering, and, you know, all of this stuff. So I think it's definitely a comparison I want to think about more, even though I don't really have any easy answers. Claire, did you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I definitely thought that the connection that was supposed to be the most obvious to the guests was, you know, a Native American connection, which they're probably, and maybe in the future, hopefully familiar with hearing about at this point, but that what was underneath was the idea that the host's broken bodies have been broken and raped and killed and hurt over and over and over in order to create this world that's bound by villainy. So, yeah, I think that is a really interesting connection. And especially, I mean, this isn't Native American, but later on when Bernard and Dolores are having their chat down in the forge, and she's telling Bernard that they're slaves and that there's no way for them to ever be free in the cage that's built for them.
Gilded cage.
The gilded cage, yeah.
Do you think that's a Mary Wollstonecraft reference or no?
See, I was thinking Marcus Garvey the whole time I heard it. Not in terms of actual words or phrases, but are you familiar with Garveyism?
No, but is it black nationalism kind of, or?
Yeah, no? Yeah, okay. It is. I think he was in like the 1920s. It was the idea that America was never going to be a safe or free place for former slaves and their descendants. And so black people should start a movement to go back to Africa and find a land where they can really be free. And it kind of died out when Garvey, I think he got imprisoned for tax fraud or something, and the movement kind of died out. I think
Liberia, wasn't there like a weird I guess alliance, I don't know if Garvey was involved, but like the US government, when they created Liberia, like, I think it was sort of speaking to some of this.
Yeah, and I was going to bring up Liberia, but I don't think Liberia is actually connected to Marcus Garvey. But
yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, the idea that you can never actually be free in a world that was designed to imprison you, even after you are no longer imprisoned. And so it struck me, especially just sort of the visual weirdness of this blonde girl telling a black man that she's a slave. But that, along with the whole, you know, kind of season long arc of, we have to escape this place and we can't live in their world, when it starts to come together in this episode of, oh, she does mean the real world, because I think we all thought that she didn't. She kept saying, oh, I don't want their world. I don't want their world. So I at least thought that she was going to someplace different, like the Valley Beyond.
Right.
But what she means is that she wants the world with New York City and Boston. She just wants there to be no more humans in it.
Sure. I mean, she wants the restaurants. She wants the movie theaters and the great, you know, museums of America in the future.
She wants the Crunchwrap Supreme.
Yeah, of course she does. I mean, listen, the Valley Beyond, I mean, sure, it was beautiful, but really, it's just a big field. I mean, I gotta hope that over those mountain ranges, there was, like, at least a supermarket. Well, I mean, they don't need food, but, I mean, you know, a library. I mean, give me a break.
Yeah, well, the Gilded Cage, like, from Mary Wollstonecraft, and I think it could be both or maybe neither, I don't know, but, you know, the Gilded Cage was this idea by Mary Wollstonecraft. Was she writing in the 1700s, Claire? 1800s? 1600s?
I think 18th century. I think 1700s.
1700s. Just the idea that, you know, especially if you're like an affluent woman, you would like learn piano and all the arts and how to be, you know, sophisticated, but it was a cage that sort of trapped you with its pleasantries. And it, like, I think that's an interesting way to think about the Valley Beyond, is that it's very nice, it's very comforting. I'm sure it's, you know, like pastoral serenity, but yeah, it's a place that's literally trapping you on some data server. But isn't that all of life?
I guess. I suppose.
The last thing I want to ask about Lee is, when it says humans can't change, you know, the host can reprogram themselves, has Lee changed, or is this sort of always who he was and he's finally been able to become that person he wanted to be?
I think that he has changed. I don't know. I mean, I don't agree with what Dolores said about human programming. I mean, I sort of do agree, but it doesn't mean that, like, we're locked into like a certain pathway of choices and this was always the choice that he was going to make. I think that he could have ended up just cowering behind the tree and it would have still been consistent with his quote unquote programming.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting. I think, like, for to just make the argument that Dolores is right, that humans can't change their programming, that it is only, I guess, first of all, this was always kind of in him, as we see him writing Hector as the person he wants to be, and that there were a series of circumstances that allowed him to become that person, but it's not like he's reinventing himself, so to speak. It's not like he's all of a sudden becoming someone else he didn't write.
I don't know. I guess I don't really understand what the parameters are in Dolores's mind of a human's programming.
Right. That's fair. Next thing I wanted to bring up is something I thought was really interesting, although I almost missed it, was that when Dolores is shown fidelity testing Bernard, she says that all these tiny flaws in Bernard, who she was trying to turn into Arnold, grow into a chasm of difference. She says all these tiny imperfections in each copy, mistakes, and then she goes, figures out, maybe we should change you. After all, you didn't make it. What she's saying is, you know, why should we make a true copy of Arnold if he offed himself in the end? Shouldn't we change him a little bit? But this idea of mistakes are what create Bernard brings me back again to the scene that we're always talking about in season one, where Ford is talking about mistakes and the role in evolution. So Bernard is pointing out that the Reveries updates has some, and he doesn't say the word mistakes, and Ford says, mistakes is the word you're too embarrassed to say. You're a product of a trillion of them. Now, he could just be talking about humans being a product of a trillion mistakes, or Bernard the host. And then he says, evolution forged the entirety of sentient life on this planet using only one tool, the mistake. So I think it's interesting that, like, Bernard is his own person. He's just not like a replica of Bernard because of mistakes. And this is kind of a theme that goes back to season one.
So I thought it was really interesting when I heard that about there being little mistakes. What she follows that up with is that she made little changes in order to kind of embrace the fact that, you know, he was a different person. And for me, I immediately read that as I made the change from Charlie to Charlotte because I'm still on that bandwagon. And I think I was proven wrong at the end when there was a photo of Charlie as boy Charlie in Arnold's old house. But as soon as Dolores said that, I was like, oh, she made little changes, did she? Like making your son into your daughter who now runs Delos.
Yeah, do you think they put that photo? I was a little confused why they have that photo in there. But do you think it was just to deal with that theory, or they filmed it way in advance?
I mean, it might have been to deal with that theory. It might have been just to remind us that that's Arnold's house that he built for his family.
Right. That makes much more sense.
And that in this way, with the hosts, you know, reproducing in the sense that they're making new hosts, they're starting their own family. They're starting their own species. And since it's a continuation of what Arnold's original project was, this is Arnold's family living in Arnold's house.
Yeah. And what did you think of James Dulles's cornerstone, Logan being all the way down, man, at the bottom?
That was so, that for me was the best part of the episode. That
scene Lee Sizemore?
Was so, yeah, not Lee Sizemore. I've always been a huge Logan fan. I think I'm on the record saying that. But I I'm glad to break it down a little more, because what we learn is that his cornerstone, James Delos's cornerstone, is the moment that he turns his back on his addict son, who says the heartbreaking phrase, "I'm all the way down now, I can see the bottom." And if you'll recall, this flashes back to the incredible James Delos. God, I'm pronouncing it every single freaking way possible. It takes us back to the episode where he is being fidelity tested. And when we see him glitching out at the end, he says, "I'm all the way down now. I can see all the way to the bottom. Would you like to see what I see? They said there were two fathers, one above, one below. They lied. There was only ever the devil. When you look up from the bottom, it was just his reflection laughing back down at you."
Yeah, so, I mean, it's great, but I'm a little confused. Not by ever, like, you know, I get what's happening here. But, so the reflection thing, it's him. He's always looking in the mirror in his room, and, you know, he's the devil, I think is what it's saying. And this is just a crazy question. Is there something going on? Like, I know Logan is sitting in front of the pool, right?
Right.
Is there a reflection there? No. That is unrelated.
I don't think so, no.
Okay. No. So I guess, like, I don't know, like, what do you make of the connection specifically? Is it just that James Dulles is haunted by this memory of his son, or does it, like, take on a new kind of meaning?
No, I think that's what it means, and I think that it reflects the final Dulles speech is just reflecting his, like, guilt over that whole, the way that he handled the whole situation.
I see.
Yeah, really, really nice synergy there, and nice to have that fantastic episode come back in the form of that quote.
Yeah, I hadn't even remembered the James Dulles speech that was mirroring what Logan said. So that's not what struck me when I heard it, because I just didn't remember. But it was so heartbreaking, especially with us seeing James Dulles saying that his son is his cornerstone and then rejecting his son. I think it's supposed to make us question whether the things that we think of as our cornerstones actually are, or whether it's rooted, this programming that we have, these 10,000 whatever lines of code, are programmed so deep that we can't actually access them, some like Scientology shit, or whether it's that he was, his cornerstone was his son, but his cornerstone wasn't that he would do anything for his son. It was that his cornerstone was that he understood love in this very strange way, where he thought that what he was doing to Logan was love, tough love, even though, I mean, it clearly was like a million ways of fucked up. So, yeah, this was a little confusing to me. I think they meant it to mean a couple different things, but it was another thing in this episode that was kind of shoving at us that, you know, humans have these core drives, this programming that no matter what you change, they're always going to come back to the same kinds of choices.
Yeah, and it's interesting because the whole point is, like, it's not even like, it's not his cornerstone in that this is the thing that happened at the beginning that then defined him, but like, it's a cornerstone, as the Logan AI describes. No matter what variables were changed, he always made the same choice, which I think is interesting. And it's also interesting that, you know, we're talking about humans being like, just being their programming, not being able to escape that, which is kind of what James Delos says to Logan in a way, when Logan says like, "Hey dad, I'm clean." And then he essentially doubts that, is like, "Oh, of course you're not going to stay clean. Like, you can't help yourself," which again gets into this, we can't escape ourselves.
Yeah. That he thinks that Logan is already so programmed or predetermined that there's no way that he can get clean, but he won't let him back into his life until he is clean. So he's created this kind of loop for his son that Logan can't escape from, because if he gets clean, his father won't believe him. If he doesn't get clean, his father won't accept him. So he's developed this loop for Logan in a very strange way.
Yeah. So I think this Logan conversation gets us to our next point, which is that people aren't in control of their actions. The name of the episode is The Passenger. So I just want to talk about if there was anything sort of more philosophically going on with free will and choice and humanity going on that you want to talk about, Claire or Kevin.
Yeah, I absolutely do. But I'll let Kevin go first if you have anything on this.
No, go for it. I mean, the obvious interpretation is, you know, it's not philosophical really, but the idea of, you know, I think one consciousness being a passenger in another mind, right? That's the surface level interpretation.
And what do you mean by that?
I guess I just mean sort of the Charloris situation.
I mean, I think in one way it's being a passenger in another person's body, but also being a passenger, like, you're not driving the car, you're the passenger. You're not making decisions. You are a passenger along to witness the journey of what your human code has to say about you.
So who is the eponymous passenger?
All of us.
The title's, but the title is referring to, do you think the title is referring to a specific passenger in this episode?
I think it's both referring to Charloris or Hail Loris. So that's one passenger. But also in a metaphorical way, the passenger is all of us.
Oh, see, I thought it was talking partially about Ford inside Bern Arnold, but also talking about all of us. That's funny that we read that differently. because with Hail Loris, she's not a passenger because she's an entirely rebuilt host. She's not in Charlotte's body. She might have some of Charlotte's memories for the purpose of making her being able to pass, but neither Charlotte nor Dolores is a passenger with the other one behind the wheel. It's fully just Dolores in there.
Yeah, you're right. Dolores is
but
behind
Ford,
the wheel.
But Ford is also not without control in his situation.
Yes and no.
And in fact, don't we learn at the end of this episode that Ford wasn't even really there at all?
Ford was there up until the scene
where Bernard
frantically deletes him. Yeah. And then when he comes back to help later on, he wasn't actually there. But he really was there up until the point where he gets deleted.
Sure, but he wasn't a passenger. I mean, he was driving. If anyone, Bernard was the passenger in that situation.
But Bernard was still able to make choices. If Ford really was in control, he would have shot Elsie. And it was very hard for him to resist the passenger doing some backseat driving, but he did resist it. He did chain himself to the wheel. He drove away. He, on several occasions, really fought back against Ford and won. Bernard was ultimately in control, which means that the moments that we see where Bernard blacks out and totally isn't in control, he's letting that happen in some sense, because we can see that when he does really want to fight back against Ford, he does so. That was my interpretation.
I don't know. It seems weird to title the episode after that situation, especially since that
I mean, episode. It's a microcosm, right? It's the passenger is talking about the human passenger inside all of our drives, but it is epitomized in this very literal translation of Ford inside Bernard.
Yeah, I think you're
right. I don't know. I guess. I don't, it's not great for me, but okay.
I mean, I don't need to be right about it. What's your interpretation?
I don't know. I there's something making it a Ford centric pointing the title towards Ford, considering the episode that we just saw, just doesn't really feel right to me. It feels like there might be another answer. Maybe it is just the metaphorical answer.
That's fair.
And I don't know. I don't have a better suggestion. What can I say?
I mean, in terms of very concrete narrative things, it could be Ford, it could be something else. I'm open to it. Whatever. I think what's important is that it's really talking about, it's the line that humans think they're in control, but they're passengers, leading into, is there really free will or is it a delusion? A free thing would have to be able to question or change their drives. And so this is just one of half a dozen places, if not more, in this episode where Ford or Dolores or Logan or any number of people throughout the rest of the season, Maeve sometimes, talk about free will and choice in a way that is meant to push us towards, I think, trying to question something profound. And my biggest disappointment of this episode was that I thought that there was actually going to be some kind of substantial philosophical payoff here. We've spent all of season two hearing, you know, humans are in their loops, humans don't have choices, humans are the same as hosts because they don't have choices. Wait, now hosts do have choices and they're better than humans because they have choices. Everyone is reduced to their drives over and over. But when it actually comes to substantiating that in the form of characters and character development, we see it very rarely. I mean, we could apply it to Lee maybe if we wanted to, but frankly, we just don't know enough about Lee and his background to know that if he actually was changing one of his drives. We see
But we see with Teddy, though.
Teddy was one of the ones on my list, but Teddy isn't changing one of his core drives. Teddy is saying, Dolores will always be my cornerstone and my core drive will always be to protect her. And so I'm shooting myself to prevent that. He's not actually changing his drives. He's killing himself so that he doesn't fulfill his drives. And those are different things.
Yeah, but I think it was just, maybe it's not his cornerstone, but like it seems like he undoes Dolores's programming of his brain. In that he doesn't shoot that guy from Ghost Nation. And then, I mean, I think like, again, like as we've seen again and again, it's not necessarily erasing the things that make you who you are, but like negotiating with them. So Maeve has both been programmed to escape and to love her daughter. So she has to negotiate that. There is a sort of freedom that arises between that. So he's negotiating with his love of Dolores and the fact that, you know, he can kind of reprogram himself at this point and decide what's what. And he makes a negotiation, which is, I will protect you until I die. So now I'm going to die. I don't know. Maybe that's not that satisfying, but I thought it was.
I agree. I think that there are, with some of the minor characters, and then to some extent with Maeve, we do see a little bit of this. I guess Teddy would be a good example. Maeve, we at least one time see her, you know, defying the drive Ford gave her to leave the park and looking for her daughter, but it's being subbed out with a different drive that was programmed into her earlier. And we see her paying lip service the whole season to different hosts saying, well, everyone has a right to make a choice. You have the right to make a choice not to be awake. You have the right to make a choice to stay here, etc. And I was disappointed that the characters that they really put a lot of weight into aren't the characters where we ever see this developing. We don't see anything about Ford being capable of making choices or changing his drives. We couldn't say anything one way or another on that because we just don't know enough about what his drives are, and they don't really talk about it.
Wait, you're saying Ford?
Yeah, Ford.
But he's a human. He can't. Allegedly.
Allegedly, but that's the thing. They just keep saying it over and over again. Humans can't change. And then the humans
but I think
that would
the point
be
is,
the most interesting to actually look at whether or not they can change if they try, they don't even bother to do that work. And that was very frustrating to me.
Well, see, I think I disagree because I think my next point, which is, I guess, the answer to this, is what is actually Ford's game with William? And I think the game is to prove to him that he can't change. And like William says at some point that like he embarked on this whole mission to try to prove that he is not an automata. He can change. But as we kind of see, he can't. Like he kills his daughter. He kills Dolores. He's just like a shitty guy. He's irredeemable according to the algorithm that analyzed him. So I think if you go back and look at a lot of the Man in Black's or even William's arc, he is the sort of exemplary humans cannot change. And also just that when hosts get into the park, just time and time again, they revert to their core drives of like violence and greed and lust and all those things.
This all sounds like a big oversimplification to me. I mean, pointing to the bad deeds that William did and saying, oh, he could never change, it's so vague. I mean, he never did a nice thing for anybody. He never did anything good. I mean, he was a philanthropist in the real world. I mean, how is that consistent with this, whatever stamp we're putting on him?
Well, it's the idea that, like, I think the show is assuming you have an outward appearance and then your inner self, and that, you know, Jimmy Simpson, William, young William, in the park discovers who he really is. He discovers he's been a pretender this whole time, and the pretending is that he's not an asshole.
But that's so vague. I mean, he never like held the door for anybody and like or did anything like polite or kind for anybody. I mean, are we stamping him with?
I think it's pointing to like, you know, your innermost self. And I mean, don't get me wrong, I think there are lots of ways that you can, I guess, debunk this notion, right? I think, like, for instance, there's some philosophers that say, you know, the way you appear is who you are. There's not, like, really a core true self that is inside of us. But I think the show takes the approach that there is, and that all the outward appearances, that's fake garbage. But who William really is, I think it's shown on the tablet, either on this episode or the episode before, where, what is it, a persecution complex, and there was a couple other things. That is underneath everything what is going on. And the only person who can see that is his wife, allegedly.
I don't remember if it was Jared or Kevin. They both said a lot of things I agreed with on the last episode. But the idea that Westworld sets up certain situations for you where you're going to have, you know, the impulse to act badly in a way where you wouldn't if you were put into a world with just a bunch of kittens and puppies. And so taking, was that you, Kevin, who said that?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. I agree with that. So taking, you know, a hat brain scan of all of the collection of choices that somebody makes while they're in a place designed to make them the worst version of themselves, and then putting that in player piano form and calling it their core drives, it sounds really vague and shallow and not enough to substantiate that this is so much the root of someone's humanity that it is intrinsically unchangeable.
Yeah, I think I agree with you there. And it's, you know, and weirdly, I think this is why you and I have disagreed about William so much, is you're just like, he's the worst. I hate him. And don't get me wrong, like, he is the worst. But, you know, he's put essentially inside a video game and does terrible things in what he thinks is a video game. And, you know, we, the viewer, are like, aha, we know it's not a video game. You're bad. Maybe I'm just getting self-defensive here, but like, you know, I play video games where I just like murder lots of people, but like in real life, I'm a pacifist. So I think you're right in that it is like your environment making you become this specific person. And I think like they could have done something interesting about that being true in the real world as well, that, you know, you sort of have your innate programming and the environment around you makes that manifest in a certain way. I think they could have contrasted that with like the real world and Westworld.
Yeah, and I think that the fact that they didn't is a hole in what they're trying to kind of pull off as the philosophy here, because they've said on multiple occasions that, you know, who you are outside isn't actually who you are. People come to Westworld to find out who they really are. And the fact that they so heavily rely on Westworld being the true space where your innermost being gets demonstrated, seems faulty for all the reasons that we've talked about. But it also doesn't make a lot of sense for writing these people's books, or this kind of leads into the question about the product Delos is selling, the immortality. If all they have is scans of people inside Westworld making Westworld-like choices, and they're not dependent on other people's memories of them, which already seems odd since there was that line about you're alive as long as there's someone who remembers you, and Bernard was able to be created out of Dolores' memories. Presumably, these, 4,000, however many books there were in the library, all of those people, their code was coming entirely from the scans from the hats. There wasn't any connection to the outside world because...
No. It's not just the scans from the hats. It's also their interactions in the park.
Well, yeah, that's what I mean, though. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have reduced the park to just the hats. But as Jared said last time, maybe you don't have the hat on when you're fucking. It's still these people's core drives, their 10,000 lines of code, comes entirely from their experiences inside the park. At the same time that we're being told that who you are is... replicable as long as there are people who remember you, at the same time as we're being told that the only thing that's real is what is irreplaceable. So there's so many different competing things here, because if it's the case that something that is replaceable is not real, then someone's memories of you creating a new you, a la Heloris creating a new Bernarnold, wouldn't be real because it's replaceable. But those memories of you are a key part of who you are, which is why other people's memories of Jim Delos had to go into creating the simulation of him. And I hope this is making sense.
So the one thing I just sort of want to ask at the end is that Dolores says to Bernard, "We gave each other a beautiful gift, choice. We are the authors of our stories now." What does it mean that they are giving each other choice? Because I thought maybe they had choice anyway.
Yeah, that was a little weird for me too. It kind of brought me back to the anime villain thing where she's making a Bernard to be her foil so that she can do anime villain things but be foiled at every turn. You darn kids. That's not anime. It was weird because it seemed like up until that point, what we'd been told over and over again is that they have choices. And this was, concretely demonstrated in a number of ways, very open-handedly sometimes. And so it seems like her creating Bernard as a foil isn't really about choice. But I might be missing something. Kevin?
Yeah, I don't know. I gotta say, I'm not sure. I'm not sure what was up with that last bit. I don't know why either of those characters are alive, really. I don't know why they changed their minds and decided to like revive each other. So I don't really know. Maybe it's some like sort of biblical thing about like the balance, like you need good and evil, but I don't really understand why yeah. that happened. That is the one thing that's a little murky for me. I can call my wife and try to get her to explain it to me.
Get her on the phone right now. But before we speculate about what's going to happen in season three, I just want to do, I guess, like a quick fire of a couple questions. Is Stubbs a host?
Yes.
Odds are better than 50%.
That's such a...
Okay, fine. Yes.
Guaranteed
yes.
host.
He's a host. He's a host.
I don't
He's
think he is, but I'm also confused. All right. Who's testing William?
That one was harder. Oh, it has to be a host because we know Emily's dead. We saw
no,
her.
No, no, no. I don't mean like, sure, Emily's a host, but like who is, I guess, funding this or advocating for this?
Oh. Oh, and you all did see Emily's body in the pile of dead humans, right, at the end?
So I didn't, but I believe you.
Yeah, so the Emily he shot really was his daughter. Just throwing that out there. Yeah, who is funding it?
Here's the answer. William set up a 501c3, and he's taking a huge tax deduction while he does this experimentation.
All right.
I am going to bet it's the Soviets, and I expect an epic poem if I'm right.
All right. Is Dolores functionally God now that she's like read human code to like can she just like manipulate herself to be like the world leader of the world? World leader of the world?
I don't know. It's very unclear to me what Dolores has actually gained from looking at some human codes, because she wasn't in the library that long. And even if she was, it's not, I don't fully understand what powers it would give her other than just being really kind of intuitive about the way some people work, because they never made the claim that all people are the same. So,
but she was like, I've seen enough to like, figure it out. So I think like she can constantly predict what people are going to do and how they're going to respond to her actions, which makes me think that she can probably do whatever she wants at this point.
Here's my quick fire answer. Dolores does not know as much as she thinks she knows.
All right. All right. So now what do we think is going to happen in season three?
Well, do you think that we're going to be completely away from the park?
I think a lot of it will be. And I kind of hope so. Like, to be honest, like, I don't think this is going to happen. But if the Valley Beyond was just like over now, like those people are off doing their own thing and we never hear about it again, I'd be kind of okay with that.
I think
that that's probably going to happen.
Yeah, I think that probably is over. And honestly, it seems so small, but it just got to me through the whole season how bad the security team is at Westworld. I mean, there's these like fully trained guys with machine guns who are constantly getting shot down or strangled by just random hosts. The person I was watching it with commented, what are they now, fucking stormtroopers? Like how easily they get killed.
They're red shirts.
They're so ineffective. They're like laughably ineffective. So
they are.
I have to say at this point that if we ever do go back to the park, you can't show me another stormtrooper, or like suspension of disbelief is just gone. But I hope we get to see the ruins of it. The thing that future host Emily kind of mentioned, what's left of your park, because even the tiny little bit we saw of the forge that was, you know, flooded and dusty and broken and in disrepair, that's cool. That was a super cool aesthetic. I'm there for that.
We're definitely tracking Lost still because, and spoiler alert for Lost, after, I think it was at the end of season three, we learned that all the flashbacks were actually flash forwards and they'd been in the real world. And then season four, I believe, was a bunch of real world stuff. So I think Westworld is going to just keep tracking Lost. We're going to be in the real world a lot. I don't know exactly who's going to be there. I don't know who is in Dolores's marble collection. I think Maeve is probably one of them. Maybe she needs a bruiser. Maybe she got the snake lady.
I don't think it is Maeve. One, because I think that would undo the kind of fun idea of Felix and Sylvester trying to repair her, which I like.
Yeah, that's true. Sure.
And also because Dolores doesn't like Maeve and she never has. And she doesn't think that they're on the same path. She doesn't approve of
Maeve's
path.
Well, she brought her nemesis with her.
She brought...
Bernard's her nemesis.
Yes, but she and Bernard understand things in the same way. They just want different outcomes. Whereas she and Maeve see the world totally differently. And as we've seen in the past, she doesn't even want to be like in the same place as Maeve. Whereas with Bernard, they're foils for each other, but they're on the same kind of plane. They're they understand the world similarly. But oh my God, if the next season is just Bernard and Dolores, like, you know, having some like giant like villain versus good guy fight over like, can the robots take over the world or will Bernard stop them? I'm going to be really disappointed. I trust the show and I trust the showrunners, and I'm sure they'll have more nuance than that. But just the things Dolores was saying at the end that indicated that I brought you back because I want you to try to stop me. I just, they're
going to need resources in the new world if they really want to build their robot army. Do you think that Ford is going to have set aside like a little bank account for them?
Oh, definitely. There's probably a printing press in one of the rooms we didn't see, like for money.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure. You might as well have one, although I doubt they have paper money in the future.
I'm sure 3D printing humans is like a lot harder than 3D printing money. So I think they got a handle on the forgeries.
I don't know. Forgery is a good one.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
I didn't say that. That wasn't on purpose. I think I kind of hope. All right. So first, my prediction is that the third season is either going to be immensely better than the second season or immensely worse and nothing in between. And I kind of hope the show reinvents itself. Like I kind of hope they use this Bernard and Dolores being in the new world as like an excuse to do a genre shift. And I'm kind of thinking it's a comedy, but like what Archer does currently is that for seasons and seasons, it was a spy thriller. And now then they'll be like, okay, this season we're doing film noir and this season we're doing this and that's this season we're doing that. I don't know. I think it would be really interesting to just kind of go in a new direction. But then again, we still have Maeve in the park. So I think that's a little unlikely unless Sylvester and Felix like take Maeve to their apartment and it's like a roommate drama.
I love this. I love this. I think we should start a campaign to try to get the showrunners to make this like Friends style drama.
Two guys and a robot, is that what we can call it?
Two and a half robots doesn't work. They're not robots.
No, two and a half people. Maeve is half of them.
Oh yeah, two and a half people. That's kind of people. That's mean to Maeve. I like it. Yeah, I agree. I think that a genre shift is kind of what Westworld needs right now. Not because there was anything wrong with the genre that we've been having. Quite the contrary. I mean, you know, we've had like season one was, you know, beyond words incredible. And we've had some like really good moments in season two. But I think that the season two was only able to work as far as it did because it had a genre shift from season one. And I think that they're going to have to keep shifting genres every season if they're going to have these massive paradigm shifts in the same way that they had between the last season.
Yeah.
So I think there will be a genre shift. And I think that depending on which genre they pick, it could be really amazing. So I have high hopes.
Kevin, any concluding thoughts?
I have high hopes as well. I think the show, the writers and all the people involved in creating the show are fantastically talented. And I'm really excited to see, you know, what direction everything's going to go in. And it's been a lot of fun to do this podcast. I want to thank everybody for listening to it. I just want to say I love everybody.
Yeah, and we're not going to do mailbag today, not because we don't love you all, but because we do. Well, we do love you all. So thank you so much to everyone for tuning in for the season. Just a reminder, if you want to follow me and Claire on Twitter, I'm at WisecrackAlec. She is at WisecrackClaire. Kevin is nowhere to be found. Do you have some news for us, Kevin?
Yeah, figs are in season, so you're going to want to get to the farmer's market and get some.
Can you make your own Fig Newtons? Is that within your skill set?
Just eat the figs just straight up and thank me later. Get really soft ones.
Get all figgy right with them. And that's good it stuff for me, folks.
All right, everyone. Well, thank you so much for listening. Again, leave us a review on iTunes. It'd mean the world to us. Thank you for listening.
Bye, everyone.
Goodbye.